As long as there's a nation here, there's going to be a God. He will not be outlasted by any of the nations. And what he's really saying is that he's going to last forever. I'm first and with the last. I am he. So God was responsible for all of this, and God originated all the nations. And verse 5, the isle saw it and feared. The ends of the earth were afraid, drew near, and came. Now the isle saw it. Here again we're talking about the distant nations. Those nations that would comprise any of the other nations in the world. He said they saw it and feared. That is, they saw this rising up of Cyrus. They saw his conquering ability. And it caused them to have some alarm. It caused them to have some fear. The ends of the earth. Here again, this is the distant nations. The nations that were at the very far ends of the earth. And that is the understanding that's caused by the wording here. The ends of the earth, or the distant nations, were afraid. They drew near and came. Now what he's saying here is that all these nations, when they saw what Cyrus was doing, God was carrying out his purpose, that they made alliances with each other for self-defense. They drew together. They came together. They used all the resources that they could muster against this force of Cyrus, and they were not able to do anything, of course. Verse 6, they helped everyone his neighbor, and everyone said to his brother, be of good courage. Now this is what they were doing as God was bringing about this destruction upon them. They decided to have an alliance and help each other, and they were encouraging each other, and everyone was saying to his neighbor, or to his brother, be of good courage. So, in verse 7, so the carpenter encouraged the goldsmith, and he that smootheth with the hammer, him that smote the anvil, saying, it is ready for the soldering. Now, when he says the carpenter encouraged the goldsmith, he's talking about the practice of making idols. These people who made idols, this was quite a business, as we studied about in the last chapter. It was quite a business with them, and it took a lot of skill. Here was one man who worked in metals, and he could mix up the metal, and he could melt it, and he could pour it into the mold, and he could make a molded image. Another one, he was an engraver. He could engrave different kinds of idols. Another one, he covered the idol over with the gold or with silver. Another one made the chains of silver or gold and draped the idol with these chains. And so whenever the going got to be rough with them and they began to be afraid for their very life and their very existence, he says here that they got busy making those idols. They started making more idols then. The carpenter encouraged the goldsmith, and he that smootheth with the hammer, him that smote the anvil, saying, it is ready for the soldering, and he that fastened it with nails, that it should not be moved. In other words, as each man did his part on the making of the idols, he'd encourage the other one to do his part. One would be making the molds, one would be making the metal and pouring it in, one would be smoothing it down with the hammer on the anvil, knocking off the rough places and finishing it off, another would be putting the metal on it, and another one would be soldering. The word solder means to weld or to solder together. Maybe he was making the chains or different parts he was fastening onto it. And he that fastened it with the nails, that it should not be moved. They got busy making idols. They got busy working to their God. And he shows here the very futility of of the things that they would endeavor to do to try to gain the victory and to try to protect themselves. They were looking to the wrong source. And so in verse 8 he says, but thou, Israel, art my servant, Jacob, whom I have chosen, the seed of Abraham, my friend. Showing the contrast. Israel, you're not going to do this. You're not going to make idols. You're not going to look to false gods. Not you, Israel. You're my servant. Now, my servant here doesn't necessarily mean that they were looked upon as a slave, but it means that they were God's possession and God would take care of them. True, they were serving God, but God also in turn then would meet their needs. He would care for them. The idol was not going to care for his worshiper. He wasn't going to be able to do anything for his worshiper. But God could. Jacob, whom I have chosen, the seed of Abraham, my friend. And now, Abraham, my friend, this is a very complimentary phrase to give to Abraham, for God to call Abraham my friend. Abraham was called the friend of God. And this is one of the places where he's called that. And so they're the seed of Abraham. They're the offspring of Abraham. Thou whom I have taken from the ends of the earth and called thee from the chief men thereof and said unto thee, Thou art my servant. I have chosen thee and not cast thee away. Now, he's referring in verse 9 to Abraham. Abraham, my friend. He says, Thou whom I have taken from the ends of the earth. Now, the ends of the earth is a distant, far place, and in the case of Abraham, it was Chaldee. And the land of the Chaldeans, or Chaldeans, which is where Ur was, Ur of the Chaldees, which is over at the end of the Tigris and Euphrates River, where it goes into the Gulf there. This is where the Lord had taken Abraham from. Abraham came from that country. He told him to get up and leave that country. And he says, I've called thee from the chief men thereof. And this word chief men means the kingdoms or the extremities thereof. I've called you from those kingdoms in that area. And said unto thee, Thou art my servant. This is what I originally said way back to Abraham. Now you're the seed of Abraham and I'm saying it to you. I have chosen thee and not cast thee away. And what this really amounts to is that Abraham originally came from the country in which they now were held as captives. Babylonia wasn't very far from Ur of the Chaldees. Well, hundreds of years before, Abraham had come from Ur of the Chaldees to the land of Canaan. Now, they were carried from Canaan into Babylonia into captivity, which is in the vicinity of where Abraham originated from. And so as God reminds them of having called Abraham and brought him out of that area, it is an allusion then also to the fact that he's going to do the same thing to them. So in verse 10, fear thou not, for I am with thee. Now fear thou not, for I am with thee. Be not dismayed, for I am thy God. And the word dismayed here means to be anxious. Be not anxious, for I am thy God. Now I'll tell you, it takes an awful lot of faith and dependence as we go through the trials and the storms and the insecurities of this life to be able to take this teaching here all the way to heart and to say that I'm not going to be bothered one iota by things. I'm going to go strictly according to what this says. He says, Be not dismayed, for I am thy God. Be not anxious. I will strengthen thee. Yea, I will help thee. Yea, I will uphold thee with the right hand of my righteousness. Promises over and over again there. And we have some of these repeated in the New Testament. I'd like to turn to Hebrews 13 and read there, Hebrews 13, verse 6. So that we may boldly say, The Lord is my helper, and I will not fear what man shall do unto me. We may boldly say, The Lord is my helper, and I will not fear what man shall do unto me. Now, this is God's people who can say this. Nobody else can say this. The one who's not following God, the one who's not obeying God, cannot say this. They may think they can say it, but they can't say it. Again, in Romans, the 8th chapter, and beginning with the 31st verse, Paul expresses a thought very similar to this. What shall we then say to these things? If God be for us, who can be against us? Now think of that just for a moment. If God be for us, who can be against us? There's no force. No man, no group of men, no institution, no organization, seen or unseen, spiritual or physical, that can be against us if God be for us. But now there's that if in there. There's that condition. We have to first of all have God to be for us. And let's read the rest of this passage in Romans 8. He that spared not his own son, but delivered him up for us all, how shall he not with him also freely give us all things? Who shall lay anything to the charge of God's elect? It is God that justifieth. Who is he that condemneth? It is Christ that died, yea, rather that is risen again, who is even at the right hand of God, who also maketh intercession for us. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation, or distress, or persecution, or famine, or nakedness, or peril, or sword? As it is written, for thy sake we are killed all the day long. We are accounted as sheep for the slaughter. Nay, in all these things we are more than conquerors through him that loved us. For I am persuaded that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor powers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor height, nor depth, nor any other creature shall be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus our Lord. Now, nothing can separate us from this love. But of course, there's that condition. We must be acceptable to God. We must be according to God's purpose. So let's read this verse 10 again. Fear thou not, for I am with thee. Be not dismayed, for I am thy God. I will strengthen thee. Yea, I will help thee. Yea, I will uphold thee with the right hand of my righteousness. Behold, verse 11, all they that were incensed against thee shall be ashamed and confounded. Now those that were incensed against thee, of course, in the time that he's speaking of, were the Babylonians. Those who had conquered them and taken them into captivity, they were the Babylonians. They were incensed against thee, and he says, they shall be ashamed and confounded. And these words, ashamed and confounded, really can mean overcome and destroyed. They're going to be overcome and destroyed, all those that were against you. They shall be as nothing, and they that strive with thee shall perish. Now they shall be as nothing. And verse 12 really repeats all of this, but it means that they're going to be entirely destroyed. Those who were so mighty, those who were your conquerors, those who held you in captivity for 70 years, they're going to be destroyed. They're not going to exist in the future. They're going to cease to exist on this earth. Now verse 12, it repeats it. Thou shalt seek them, and shalt not find them, even them that contended with thee, as they that war against thee shall be as nothing, and as a thing of naught. They're not going to exist any longer when I get through with them, God says. You're going to look for them, and you're not going to be able to find them. They're going to be as though they were of nothing. For I, the Lord thy God, will hold thy right hand, saying unto thee, fear not, I will help thee. So whatever the problems were, whatever the distresses, he says, I'm going to hold your right hand. And I'm going to say, fear not, I will help thee. Now we can't imagine any more comforting, any more soothing, strengthening words than these very words right here. But these are the words now that the Lord has intended that we have. Holding the right hand, I will say, fear not, I will help thee. And of course, really, you know, if we had all the strength in the universe, which we would have with God on our side, what more could we ask that he would say for us? Fear not, I will help thee. All we want is some help. That's what he gives. All we want is security so we don't have to have fear. And that's what he says. Now he repeats this in verse 14. Fear not, thou worm Jacob, and ye men of Israel. I will help thee, saith the Lord, and thy Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. Now he says, fear not, thou worm Jacob. The fact that he calls Jacob a worm indicates that he does realize how inconsequential, how insignificant, how utterly powerless Jacob really is. And we have this referred to in some other passages. In some other passages of the scripture now, the fact that Jacob is called a worm, it's also referred to so that we can get an idea of what he's talking about. In Job 25, verses 5 and 6, "Behold, even to the moon, and it shineth not, yea, the stars are not pure in his sight, how much less man that is a worm, and the son of man which is a worm." So that's the reference that Job has, calling man a worm, showing the inconsequential nature of man there, as he's referred to as a worm. Again, in Psalms 27, verse 6, we have this same thought given. "And now shall mine head be lifted up above mine enemies round about me. Therefore will I offer in his tabernacle sacrifices of joy. I will sing, yea, I will sing praises unto the Lord." Well, I got the wrong verse there. It's Psalms 22, verse 6. "But I am a worm and no man, a reproach of men and despised of the people." So when man wants to degrade himself, there's apparently not any greater way to do it than to declare himself to be a worm, because a worm is thought of in an entirely negative, lowly sense. But here he says in this 14th verse, "Fear not, thou worm Jacob, and ye feeble men of Israel." Now the word, or rather ye men of Israel, and this word here that means men, is also translated as feeble or few. So fear not, thou worm Jacob, and ye few or ye feeble of Israel. I will help thee, saith the Lord. So we see that the Lord doesn't expect his people to have to be great or numerous or mighty or powerful or popular. The Lord has promised he's going to help the ones that could be referred to as a worm, as feeble, as few. "Behold, I will make thee a new sharp threshing machine or instrument, having teeth. Thou shalt thrash the mountains and beat them small, and shall make the hills as chaff." Now, this threshing instrument that he's talking about here, in the day and time in which this was written, the way that they thrashed their grain, it's referred to as corn, but it really is what we'd call milo or maize or high gear today. The way that they thrashed this, they took the bundles of grain and they'd pile them up in rows, which they call winnows or winrows, and they would run a sled-like device over it with pulled by oxen. And this sled-like device many times would have rollers on the bottom of it that had sharp teeth in the rollers with edges on them. And as these wheels turned over, it separated the grain from the chaff and from the stalk so that then they could then throw it up in the air and the wind would blow the chaff away and they'd have the grain left. And it was a long, tedious, hard process to thresh grain in this manner. They'd go over and over and over and over it with this threshing device to separate the chaff from the grain. But he describes Israel now. He says, "I'm going to make thee a new sharp threshing instrument, having teeth. I'm going to make you to be one. You're not going to have one, but you're going to be one. And it's going to be a new one. It's going to be sharp, and it's going to have teeth," which means that these rollers would have sharp prongs on it, which would be effective. And he says, "Thou shalt thresh the mountains and beat them small, and shall make the hills as chaff," indicating here that whatever the obstacles were that confronted them, he would make them able to overcome the obstacles. A threshing instrument that was great enough to tear down the mountains and the hills. "Thou shalt fan them, and the wind shall carry them away, and the whirlwind shall scatter them, and thou shalt rejoice in the Lord, and shall glory in the Holy One of Israel." Now, this is still talking about the use of the threshing instrument, how that it would grind these things down so that then when they were thrown up into the wind would carry the chaff away and leave only that which was beneficial. And this is an allusion and a figure that God is using, showing his people how that he's going to deliver them from their captivity. He's going to be the one who's going to be the author of and responsible for it. And he will make them, even though they are weak and lowly and faint, and even though they are worms and few, he's going to make them able to overcome all obstacles. That's simply what he's saying here. And the figure, though, not only applies to Israel in their captivity, but it also applies to God's people today who are living in the greater fulfillment of all these prophecies, which is the coming of the Messiah. And he gives another illustration in verse 17. When the poor and needy seek water, and there is none, and their tongue faileth for thirst, I, the Lord, will hear them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them. Now just imagine this. The poor and the needy seeking water, and there's none. They're thirsty. They've got to have a drink, but there's no water. Their tongue faileth for thirst. And I'm told that people who get thirsty enough to the point that they're about to starve from thirst, that their tongue swells so thick that they're not able even to talk many times. He says, when this happens, I, the Lord, will hear them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them. Now, you catch a person who doesn't have any water and his tongue is already swelled so that he can't use it and he's just about to die from thirst, there doesn't seem to be too much hope for that person. But he says, I will not let it happen. I, the Lord, I will save them. I will hear them. I will not forsake them. And he goes on and describes now, I will open rivers in high places. And the word high places here means barren hills. I'm going to make rivers in a place that's just a barren hill that doesn't have any water, doesn't have anything growing on it. I'm going to make fountains in the midst of the valley. I will make the wilderness a pool of water and the dry land springs of water. Now, you know, we've had several times the allusion of their traveling from the land of Babylonia to the land of Palestine and having to go through a desolate wilderness area to do it. He said, the voice of one crieth in the wilderness, saying, prepare the way of the Lord, make me a highway for my people to walk on. Well, now he tells about going through a desert, through a wilderness, and as they go through, he says, I'm going to open rivers in high places and fountains in the midst of the valleys. I'll make the wilderness a pool of water, and the dry land springs of water. I will plant in the wilderness the cedar, the shittah tree, which is another word for the acacia tree, and the myrtle, and the oil tree, which is another word for the olive tree. I will set in the desert the fir tree, which is a cypress, and the pine tree, which is probably the white poplar, and the box tree, which is just a term for a tall tree, together. So here out in this wilderness, I'm going to make it like a lush garden. You're going to have a pool of water. You're going to have springs of water. You're going to have fountains. You're going to have open rivers. You're going to have the cedar, the shittah tree, the myrtle, the oil tree, or the olive tree, fir tree, pine tree, the tall tree, all varieties of these plants are going to be growing and thriving in this lush area that I'm going to prepare for you right out in the middle of the wilderness or the desert, a place that ordinarily won't grow things that are of any benefit and use. I'm going to make it a lush, green, very desirable garden spot for you. Now, I'm told by those who've been in this area that it is a place that is hardly even habitable. The flies and the gnats and the mosquitoes are just almost unbearable. And the intense heat and the dryness and the vegetation so thick that you can hardly get through some places for the briars and the brush. And it's just a very miserable, desolate place in which to be. But he describes that he's going to make a complete change of this. and the purpose of it, in verse 20, that they may see and know and consider and understand together that the hand of the Lord hath done this, and the Holy One of Israel hath created it. Now my reason, he says, is so that everybody can know. Number one, is so that my people can know. And notice how he describes this. That they may see and know and consider and understand together. Now that's, you know, one of the reasons that we believe in coming together and studying the Bible. So that we can do exactly what he says here. So that we can see and know and consider and understand together. God never intended that just one person know what his will is. He intended that as many as were interested get together and share their knowledge and share their study and understanding and their explanation of these things. That they see and they know and they consider and they understand together. Know what? That the hand of the Lord hath done this, and the Holy One of Israel hath created it. So that's his whole reason here in doing this, so that they would know that God was the one who led them. He was their God. He was their guide. He was their protector. Not only would his people know it, but also all of these nations round about, these nations, would also then know that God had done this for them. And so we see then God presenting his arguments to the people, and we're going to get in the next verse. We're going to stop there. But beginning in the next verse, even stronger arguments now as to why that God is the true and living God. He's really going to get some very strong arguments as he tells them that he's able to foretell future events and challenges them to foretell these events. But we're going to close at that point in verse 20, seeing how that God is arguing to the nations, presenting his case, as it were, for them to see and to try to tear down and argue against, if they're able, that he is the God of his people and he will lead them out, and he is the living God, stronger than any other force that they can encounter. So we'll close there at verse 20 and begin then next time, Lord willing, with verse 21.
See you.